Arizona and its schools have a deal. Lawmakers are expected to vote on a settlement to the ongoing funding lawsuit this week. But there's still the issue of getting more money into classrooms.
We currently are 48th. Idaho and Utah are the only states that are funded at a lower level than Arizona. And this still keeps us at 48th. With this additional money added, we don't go up, we just don't go any further down.
I'm Mark Brody. Also today on the show, a conversation with the Arizona Republic's new publisher. High hopes for Arizona's medical marijuana industry, and Tempe looks to divert more of its trash.
It has all the elements of everything a city government likes. It's a measurable, attainable, progressive goal that's in alignment with the city's values that doesn't cost anyone any money.
Plus, attempting to make downtown Mesa hip and restoring a picturesque preserve. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 88 degrees. Clear skies on the way for tonight with overnight lows in the mid-60s. Right now in Phoenix, partly sunny, 87 degrees. The Arizona Motor Vehicle Division has changed the way it scores one of the most stressful parts of the behind-the-wheel driver's test. According to the new scoring system, drivers will only have one chance to parallel park and execute a three-point turn. Instead of three chances to pass or fail, the new system is based on points. Ryan Harding with the Arizona Department of Transportation says drivers can get 8 points of infractions before the test is over.
You know, they only committed a couple of infractions and earned 2 to 4 points. Well, you know, they still pass, and it's okay because, again, the point is we're not trying to see if they can parallel park so much as can you handle the vehicle, can you maneuver the vehicle. That's what we really want to see.
The new scoring system has been put into place statewide. Harding says the change was done to save time, allowing for more road tests to be given over the course of a day. It's been a busy few days for education advocates in Arizona. Lawmakers are being briefed on the details of a proposed settlement deal reached late last week, and a special session could start as early as tomorrow. At issue is a court ruling that the legislature shorted schools' voter-approved money for inflation during the Great Recession. We have a few perspectives on this deal and the prospects for its approval, and we start with Chuck Essex, Director of Government Relations for the Arizona Association of School Business Officials. That's one of the parties on the lawsuit, which was filed 5 years ago.
I think everybody felt it's time to get this settled, and there were some compromises made, but we think overall it's a good settlement. But the only thing it doesn't fix all the problems with school funding. It just fixes this one portion where the legislature was not adequately funding inflation. The rest of the problems that exist in our school systems in terms of their level of funding will continue.
Yeah, you mentioned the lawsuit and school funding. There's been so much discussion about whether or not schools are funded enough, how to get them more money. This settlement doesn't really address further funding. This just basically settles the lawsuit, right?
It settles the lawsuit. We currently are 48th. Idaho and Utah are the only states that are funded at a lower level than Arizona. And this still keeps us at 48th. With this additional money added, we don't go up. We just don't go any further down.
Do you think that there is any danger at the legislature of lawmakers saying, okay, we did this, we're done, we're good?
I think so. What people need to realize, they fixed it. And certainly this is not something to say, well, it's not a big deal. It's a big deal to get this settled after 5 years and get the inflation funding out to schools. But this doesn't come close to alleviating the problems on how we fund our schools. Traditional school districts and charter schools are part of this lawsuit, and this doesn't change and make either one of those systems adequately funded.
Over the past several years, we've heard so much about school boards having to make cuts, lay off teachers, increase class sizes, things like that. With this settlement, assuming that the legislature approves it and voters approve the parts that need to be voter approved, how will that change the way that schools can go about the business of running their schools?
Well, the ground that they lost to inflation during the last 5 years is, may allow them, and hopefully it will allow in some cases, for them to bring their class sizes down a little bit so they may be closer to where they were 5 years ago and kind of increase their teacher compensation so it's more competitive. And we have a real teacher shortage in Arizona, and a good part of that is the level of funding for our teachers, and it should provide some additional dollars for them.
Do you think that will help attract new teachers or keep the teachers that are already here?
I'm not sure it's enough to bring in a lot of new teachers, but hopefully it'll keep the current staffing that we have in place so we don't make the shortage more severe.
Are you satisfied with the source of where the money will be coming from, that it will be there over years for the schools to be getting it?
About 60% of this money is going to come from the state land trust dollars, which are already in the bank, and then the rest comes out of the general fund. And the legislature will be required to do this, and if not, then it's back to court. And I don't think they want to go back to court. We don't want to go back to court. So we're pretty sure that this will continue as it goes forward.
The legislature is expected to meet in special session this week. Parts of the plan obviously will have to go to the voters. Parts of them could go into effect shortly. When do you expect money to start going to schools? Like, when will your members actually start to see additional money?
I don't think they'll start to see any money because the election is tied into this plan probably until near May and June. But then the money should start flowing, and then hopefully some of that money they'll actually use for some expenses for this year, but then that'll give them a good start on the following year. But I would be really surprised if schools really got to see any dollars until almost the end of the school. Probably by the time school will be out this year before everything gets settled and before the voters get to approve it.
Do you think that they will have the money in time to make improvements for next school year?
I think for next school year is when you'll really start to see some of the impacts there. But this school year, because nobody probably wants to do anything until the election, because if it fails, then we're back to the drawing board.
Is this a settlement that you and your group are happy with, or is this a settlement that you would say that you are satisfied with and can live with?
I think we're satisfied and we can live with it. I think the other side feels the same way. I don't think the legislature feels that that this was a great deal for them. They're committed to a lot of money for a number of years. So I think neither side is out dancing this evening and saying, hey, this fixes all the problems, because it doesn't. But I think we're satisfied that at least now we have some monies that have the potential of coming to school and helping kids, so we don't have more grades of kids going through school without a system that's funded the way the voters said they wanted it funded.
Chuck Essigs is Director of Government Relations for the Arizona Association of School Business Officials. Chuck, thanks as always.
Thank you for having me.
In a statement announcing the deal, Governor Doug Ducey's office says his goal is to get the money to teachers and kids as soon as possible. For more on that, we turn to Rebecca Gao, Executive Director of Stand for Children Arizona. And Rebecca, do you think this is a good deal for Arizona students?
I think this is a really good opportunity to take a step back and be really glad that education funding is actually the subject of a special session. That is pretty good. Who thought that would happen in Arizona? So, yeah, I think given where we've been and how quickly this has all come together, I think that's a good thing.
Is there a concern on your part that by doing this settlement and in part using part of Governor Ducey's plan to tap the state land trust, that makes it harder to get additional money into school, things that have been sort of percolating about under the surface a little bit for quite a while now?
I think it's always hard to have this conversation. It's a tough conversation. But I'm not hearing anything that makes it sound like this is the end of the conversation. And honestly, Stand for Children Arizona is going to do everything we can to make sure it's not the end of the conversation. And I think other groups are going to as well.
In your mind, how will this settlement benefit students? I mean, how will they see an improvement?
Well, currently it looks like about $300 per student per year. So it's a help. We crunched some numbers on a typical school district, and over 10 years, it could be around $30 million for a district over 10 years. So if you think about it in terms of planning and continuous improvement and funding success, that gives you some time and it gives you something to work with in terms of identifying what you want to have an impact on and making it happen. It doesn't replace everything that happened through the Great Recession, and I think that's why folks are interested in making sure that the conversation continues, but it needs to be about results and outcomes and how we ensure that we're creating the best opportunities for every kid, not just about funding a system.
Obviously, this will be different based on different districts and their individual financial situations and their individual needs, but do you have a sense of, with this extra money, the kinds of things districts might be able to do, either cuts they might be able to reverse or new programs that they might be able to initiate?
Well, that's the great thing about local control, is that our system currently leaves it to local school board members to determine their own budget. So what I hope will happen, I sincerely hope that local school boards will be very mindful of what's happening with funding in school finance, that they will take a good hard look on what works. They'll take a good hard look at what hasn't worked and make really smart decisions. So we know that a lot of districts have experienced some hardships related to teachers, and so they might find really great ways to support teacher induction and really have a strong pipeline and support for new teachers. They might be able to use it to ensure that the highest quality teachers stay in the classroom and don't leave due to lack of resources. They might use it to help fund reading coaches. I think that's one thing that definitely got hurt by the Great Recession, because it's considered an administrative cost when really it's not. It's a classroom-based cost. I also hope that they'll look at career and tech education. I know that's one thing that's been cut. There are a lot of great opportunities for relevant education as early as fifth grade to really connect academics to real-world future experiences that a student might have and future job potential. So there are smart things that we know work. And so I really hope that local school districts and charters will take this as an opportunity to fund success and be very mindful.
Rebecca Gao is the executive director of Stand for Children Arizona. As I mentioned, state lawmakers are getting the details of this proposed settlement and could be called into special session starting tomorrow. Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services joins me now. And Howie, what kind of reception has this plan been getting from the rank and file?
A lot of it is, to a certain extent, wait and see. Part of the problem is nobody has actually seen the text of what's in here. Now, the Republicans have been calling some of their members in for meetings and closed caucus to answer some of the questions, how it gets put together. At this hour, the Democrats are having an open caucus to get the details. And I think they want to be sure that whatever is promised to them is, in fact, what they're getting. For example, the question of how does inflation funding work in future years? There's some triggers in there. Well, when the economy goes south, what happens? How does that come together? What happens if there suddenly isn't money in the general fund? What preconditions are there? And everyone wants a lot of details, but there seems to be a sort of cautious optimism among Republicans this will work. The Democrats have their own problems.
The state treasurer, Jeff DeWitt, has been critical in the past of the governor's plan, his original plan to tap into the state land trust. Has he weighed in on this proposal at all?
He is studying it. I talked with one of his aides this morning, and DeWitt remains convinced that the kind of withdrawals that this would call for, 6.9% of what's in the account every year, is unsustainable, in his words. Right now, you have a formula where 2.5% is taken out every year. It comes down, depending on whose numbers you use, anywhere between $70 and $90 million a year, which goes to education. The governor originally proposed to take that to a 10% withdrawal for 5 years, then 5%, then back to 2.5%. DeWitt's position is, look, maybe the 2.5% is too low, that we are earning more than that. But he says he can't go more than 3.75% without worrying that you're going to end up harming the trust. Now, the fact is the trust will continue to grow, but will it grow too slowly? I mean, if at the end of 10 years your trust is worth no more than it is now, but in current dollars it's actually worth less because of inflation, have you ended up hurting the trust and hurting future children in school because they won't have the money they need?
Interesting days ahead as state lawmakers likely to be called into a special session, perhaps starting tomorrow. Howie Fisher is Capital Media Services. Howie, thank you as always.
We'll be out here at the Capitol monitoring.
Just ahead, the contempt of court hearing against Sheriff Joe Arpaio resumed today, and a small, dedicated group of community members come to watch almost every day.
Concerned taxpayer, observing how my money, tax dollars, are being wasted.
The court regulars in just a few minutes here on the show. Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Quick check of Valley traffic. I-10 eastbound, a disabled vehicle blocks the shoulder at 67th Avenue. I-10 westbound, a collision blocks the shoulder at Guadalupe. It'll be sunny for the rest of the afternoon. Today, look for a high of 88 degrees, a few degrees warmer than average, a few degrees cooler than yesterday. 98, by the way, is the record set back in 2001. Clear skies on the way for tonight, overnight lows in the mid-60s. Partly sunny skies tomorrow and Thursday. Look for a high of 86 tomorrow, 81 on Thursday. Then we could see some rain tomorrow and tomorrow night, about a 20% chance each day. Right now in Phoenix, with relative humidity of 19%, let's call it partly sunny. 87 degrees at KJZZ at 219.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership. Featuring the 2016 Crosstrek, a 34-mpg compact utility vehicle for that go-anywhere spirit. Shop Subaru.com.
The contempt of court proceedings against Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio are underway again today in Judge Murray Snow's courtroom after a week-long recess. A small but dedicated group of community members come to listen to all the testimony. KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block spoke to a few of them about why they keep coming to court.
What do you want?
During the first several days of the contempt hearing, the courtroom was full, and a couple dozen anti-Arpaio protesters gathered outside chanting with colorful signs. Yet by now, there have been 14 days of testimony. The protests have slowed, and there are plenty of empty seats inside. A handful of regulars, though, still do make a point to come. One is Salvador Reza. He's an activist who for years has advocated for day laborers and against Sheriff Joe Arpaio and his immigration enforcement tactics.
To me, it's funny to see how karma comes around. Everything he's done to so many people, and now he's on the opposite side.
Reza has seen the judge in the case, Judge Murray Snow, question both Arpaio and his chief deputy, Jerry Sheridan, directly.
When the judge has them against the wall, you know, they get all red, you know, like their face gets all red, you know. So I wonder what they're going through. I'm sure there's fear inside of them.
Snow has to decide what kind of remedies and penalties to order for Arpaio and Sheridan. They've already admitted they're in civil contempt of court for violating Snow's orders in a racial profiling case. Snow's also going to evaluate whether their violations were willful and whether to refer the case to a prosecutor to pursue criminal contempt charges.
If I've missed one court date, it was probably because I was really, really sick.
Lydia Guzman is an activist who helped bring the successful racial profiling lawsuit against the sheriff. The plaintiffs are trying to show in this contempt hearing that there are deficiencies in how the sheriff's office disciplines officers for misconduct and handles citizen complaints. Guzman has been listening to that part with interest, since she's helped Latinos who said they were missing money after an arrest file complaints with the sheriff's office that went nowhere.
A couple of them, I actually recognize the names. I actually recognize some of the incidents. And so hearing them discussed, I kind of know that A, they fell on deaf ears over at the sheriff's office, and B, they're not falling on deaf ears here in the courtroom.
It's not only Arpaio's opponents who come watch. One man told us he comes because he feels like Arpaio is being unfairly dragged through the mud, though he refused to go on tape for this story. Another observer is Sid Apps, a former member of the Fountain Hills Town Council. He describes his interest in the case like this.
Concerned taxpayer, observing how my money, tax dollars, are being wasted.
Apps said he supported Arpaio back in 1992 during his first run for sheriff, but believes the sheriff's ego got in the way and led him astray. Apps said it's too bad that taxpayers have to foot the bill for the sheriff's missteps.
My God, and this money we're spending, how many library books, how many libraries could this build?
More than $40 million is how much the racial profiling lawsuit and court-ordered changes are projected to cost the county through the end of fiscal year 2016. In legal fees alone, this lawsuit has already cost county taxpayers more than $8 million, and that tally is expected to grow due to the lengthy contempt proceedings. Jude Joffe Block, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Flagstaff City Council has adopted a management plan for Picture Canyon. The city-owned property is on the National Register of Historic Places. For more on the area and what the city has in store for it, we turn to Betsy Emery, Flagstaff's open spaces specialist. And Betsy, first off, where is Picture Canyon?
Picture Canyon is a 478-acre preserve on the east side of Flagstaff, so it is behind the Flagstaff Mall off of Old Route 66. And it is a large archaeological and cultural resource preserve. There's all kinds of different rock art and petroglyphs, pit houses, different resources like that, and it's a really beautiful area. The Rio de Flag flows through it, and there's all kinds of riparian habitat and just really beautiful vegetated area in our city.
Is this an area that a lot of Flagstaff residents know about?
You know, more and more people have been learning about it, and we estimate that we get about 12,000 visitors a year. So not an overwhelming number of people go out, but there are a lot of key organizations that do tours out there regularly and are really involved with spreading the word.
Now, my understanding is this is an area that had fallen into some disrepair over years. Is that right?
Yeah, so about 20 years ago, there started to be a large community effort to pick up this area. There was, you know, there's a large basalt canyon that flows through the center of the preserve, and people had been dumping their cars and mattresses and all kinds of different debris into that area. And so in 2005, which is amazing that that's been 10 years now, but yeah, there was a large Make a Difference Day event out there, and they cleaned up tons, literally tons of debris and trash, and pulled all of these different abandoned vehicles and things like that out of the canyon. And that was kind of the jumping off point for them to form this Picture Canyon Working Group and really get different stakeholders involved in preserving this special place.
So what is the city council's plan now? I know that the council had taken some action on this. What is the next step?
Right. So as part of the acquisition, the city acquired that property in 2012 with Arizona State Parks Growing Smarter grant funds. And so as part of the acquisition process, we were required to produce a management plan that outlined how that preserve would be managed and also outlined different projects that we had planned for the preserve. And so we brought that management plan to council, and it was adopted on October 6th. So a huge victory for our program. And so now moving forward, we have secured almost $80,000 in funding from Arizona State Parks, their Recreational Trails Program grant funding, to do a lot of the different projects that we outlined in our management plan. So designing and installing interpretive signs throughout the trail system, putting in trail signs, entry signs, a lot of different projects that would really bring it up to that recreational bar. You know, if this is being used as a recreational center for the Flagstaff community, there are basic things that need to be done to improve our trail system and make sure that people can navigate when they're out there and they aren't getting lost and they feel safe and comfortable.
With all of the stuff that had been dumped into this area, is it totally free of all that now?
Pretty much. It's amazing how quickly the environment came back. And we did a huge restoration project out there for the Rio de Flag starting in 2008. And that was a four-year restoration project where they did all kinds of work on the riparian habitat and restored the natural meander to the channel and all sorts of things like that. So the environment has really bounced back, and there's very little trash. I'm out there once a week doing tours and trips and things like that, and, you know, maybe I'll pick up a water bottle. It's really in a great shape.
Betsy Emery is Flagstaff's Open Spaces Specialist. Betsy, thank you.
Thank you.
Arizona is known as a state that's friendly to gun enthusiasts, and this weekend was no exception. KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins attended what's billed as the world's largest machine gun shoot and fired off this report.
We all know Arizona has a lot of copper in the ground, but over the weekend, a desert canyon near Wickiup was filled full of brass and lead. $2.3 million. That's what organizers of the Big Sandy machine gun shoot estimate was unloaded over the course of the three-day event. Ed Hope runs the Big Sandy Range, a square mile of desert land he bought 11 years ago to host the biannual shoot.
Nobody else does this. There are about three or four other machine gun shoots in the U.S., but this is the largest.
More than 150 machine gun owners from around the country and hundreds more spectators from across the globe came to take part in the event. Hope says they come to his range because it's large and in a remote location. Necessary precautions for firing machine guns, whose bullets can travel for more than a mile. Hope also gives them unique targets.
I've got a crew of guys that fly model airplanes for these guys to shoot at. And of course, we'll have reactive targets all down through the little valley here in the hillside.
Explosive targets are placed throughout the range to give the shooters an extra bang for their buck. At the beginning of Saturday's afternoon session, all the shooters have their sights set on a papier-mâché duck full of black powder. The weaponry on display is extensive and expensive. Most of the shooters have come with a small arsenal.
This is a 50 caliber Browning M2. There's a Vickers water-cooled. There's a Lewis gun. There's a Breda, which is an Italian machine gun.
This is a SAW squad automatic weapon. This is a G36. That's an M16 or M4. There's another G36, and that's another SAW.
The owners are well versed in the history and the mechanism of their machines, but many struggle to estimate their value.
Oh God, I couldn't even imagine. A lot of money. A lot of money.
In 1986, Congress banned civilian possession of fully automatic weapons, but guns made before that date are still allowed to be transferred among civilian owners, and the scarcity of those guns has caused their value to skyrocket.
The 50 caliber Browning is worth between $21,000 and maybe $26,000.
Big Sandy event organizers say the total value of guns here this weekend is easily in the millions of dollars. And that doesn't even take into account the expense of the ammunition, which can be several dollars a shot.
The two guns over there with that gray mount, those are A&M-2s. Each one of those guns shoots 1,600 rounds a minute.
And at that rate, it doesn't take long to burn through thousands of dollars of ammunition, making it an expensive hobby. There are machine guns to rent for those who can't afford their own. Dave White is one of many spectators that traveled here from Canada.
We spent some time in the rental booth yesterday, shot a 50 caliber machine gun, 30 caliber, and Thompson submachine gun, the Al Capone Special. Awesome. Another thing off the bucket list. It was amazing. Yeah.
He says firearms regulations in Canada are one of the reasons many Canadian gun enthusiasts travel to the U.S.
Yeah, the freedom of Arizona and what they allow you guys to get to do down here is really an envy for the rest of the continent.
At the end of the firing line is a special section reserved for heavy artillery. There's mortars and even cannons that fire bowling balls several hundred yards. Eric Monroe is another Canadian spectator. He was surprised by the amount of firepower civilians in the U.S. are allowed to own.
It seems reasonable to do it in this environment, but then to know that these guns are in people's garages or whatever when they leave here, that's kind of a, why do you need a mortar in your home? Just leave it here until you come back next year.
Yeah. It's part of the ongoing debate over these weapons, the need for them in society versus the desire for collectors to own them. But as long as they're still legal, the shooters at Big Sandy will be back again next year. In WikiUp, I'm Jimmy Jenkins.
Phoenix is hosting the Southwest Cannabis Conference and Expo this week. It's a gathering for those in the medical marijuana industry and those looking to become a part of it. Event organizer Dimitri Downing has high hopes for the industry.
The Arizona medical marijuana market is flourishing. It will continue to flourish. We are highly accountable. We're taxed and regulated. We're demonstrating to the world and to the state of Arizona and to the country how it works to have this kind of model. One day will go adult use, and we'll be doing that as well.
He says the goal of the expo is to be transparent and educate those interested in joining the industry, as well as those seeking to regulate it. Many attendees are at the expo looking for job opportunities. Jill Walachek studies environmental science at the University of Arizona. She's graduating soon and sees a lot of potential in the industry that she isn't finding elsewhere.
Coming into college, everyone always told you to be worried about the economy and how to find a job when you came out of school. And it's cool to come to something like this where people say the industry is actually booming and there's a lot of job opportunities just for people like us who are going to be needing jobs real soon.
Eric Carlson with the National Cannabis Chamber of Commerce says it takes a staggering amount of money and effort to get a license and set up a dispensary. For the average entrepreneur looking to get into the industry, a more attainable path is through the ancillary jobs that come along with it.
70% of this industry is focused around HR consulting, SEO, web development. You know, it's no longer the build it and they will come model. It's if you have a dispensary, how do you get your customers to always go there and not your competitor down the street, right? So you're talking about sales staffs. You're talking about brand management. You know, you bring every sector of life into this.
Jerry Chesler is a cannabis industry attorney focused on finance and business development. He had some sobering advice for those looking to make a quick buck.
This is the toughest business ever. You face problems and pitfalls that no other business faces. We're overcoming 80 years of prohibition, and it makes it a tough business. You got to be able to stick it out. There's a lot of scams. Everybody's got the next greatest thing. Every grower is the greatest master grower ever, and it really helps to understand the industry.
Attendees have the chance to learn more about the industry today and tomorrow as the expo continues at the convention center downtown. Still to come, a conversation with the new publisher of the Arizona Republic. That and more still ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ, a stream of curated stories from Phoenix, our region, and around the country. With the help of reporters and producers around the region and around the globe, we'll mix the stories and news to keep you up to date and entertained. Quick check of Valley traffic, 143 northbound, a collision on the side of the road at University. Look for sunny skies across the valley today with a high of 88 degrees, few degrees cooler than yesterday. It'll be clear tonight with overnight lows in the mid-60s, partly sunny tomorrow, a high of 86. Right now it's 87 degrees at KJZZ at 235.
KJZZ is supported by Cafe Lalibela, the Valley's home for authentic Ethiopian cuisine with vegan and gluten-free dishes. Restaurant located at Hardy and University Drive in Tempe, and now at Whole Foods Markets. More at eatethiopian.com.
The state's largest newspaper is under new leadership. The Arizona Republic recently named a new publisher, and she won't have an easy job. Revenue and circulation are down as all newspapers struggle to survive in a changing media landscape. KJZZ's Phil Latsman caught up with her in her office.
Well, Mark, it's the second time around for Mia Parrish at the Republic. The 44-year-old was the paper's deputy managing editor in the late 1990s, when newspapers were still thriving. Now she returns as president and publisher of the 125-year-old institution with a major challenge: how to make print journalism profitable again. We began by discussing how Phoenix and Arizona fits into the overall strategy of the Republic's parent company, Gannett.
Well, it is a regional player, so certainly on areas that are focus areas for us, like immigration or water rights, those are things that we would be taking the forefront on. We have, certainly there have been stories that have originated here that are national stories, like the VA piece that was tremendous and had not just local ramifications, but certainly continues to have national ramifications and make a difference in our community, but also for veterans across the country. The partnering is partly because we're large and we're in a large state with a lot of news that breaks, and so we'll continue to be part of that, but also focus on things that are relevant to us. And they tend to be topic areas, you know, energy and water and immigration, that are really important and vital for people across the country.
I've spoken to a lot of print journalists, and having been one myself in the past, I know the struggle. A lot of them ask me, you know, or tell me, I just don't know if I'm going to have my job. I don't know if newspapers can stick around as presently constituted, whether it's online or in your driveway. What do you say to folks that are in newspaper business, and then translating that to the readers who may have noticed, hey, you know, that columnist is not here anymore, or maybe my city's not getting covered the way it used to? What can you tell them?
It's a time when we continue to look forward to the future state of where we need to be in the communities that we serve. And this newsroom, and I've been in a lot of newsrooms, I've worked in a lot of newspapers and a lot of news organizations, is very forward-looking, is very thoughtful about the audience and where we need to be going forward. It's structured in a way to help capitalize on that, to make sure that we're looking across all the different areas that we need to be covering and prioritizing in a smart way. It's a very digital first newsroom and will continue to be more so. So when we talk about print, I mean, print's just a piece of what we do. And I mean, literally and figuratively, you look at how we're structured, it's designed for us to be thinking digitally first.
Can you see a day where the printing press stops and the newspaper is only available online?
Well, I don't see that day anytime soon. I don't. I mean, I continue. I'm young. I like to think of myself as young. And you can see my desk is covered with paper. You know, I continue to like that experience as well. But we're going to be wherever the audience needs us to be. So if that's what it is called for, and it's not just online, I mean, it's digitally, who knows, it'll be on the wall of your shower or wherever, you know, on the backs of your contact lenses. I mean, to me, it's about the news and information. It's not about how we provide it.
Talk directly to your readers right now. What do you want to tell them about what the future of the Arizona Republic is and the newspaper industry here in Arizona?
I'm very bullish on what we do and the place that we have. I'm appreciative of the people who read us, and I think you're really smart. And I look forward to partnering really strongly with the wonderful journalists who we have here and we continue to have here. We have the largest news gathering force, and I'm proud of them and proud of the work that they do, and I'm going to do everything I can to support that going forward.
Mia Parrish, new publisher of the Arizona Republic, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Phil. Thanks for having me.
That's KJZZ's Phil Latzman. Tempe is hoping to nearly double the amount of waste it keeps out of its landfills by 2020. The city currently recycles about 13% of its waste. The goal is to get that to about 25%, and City Councilmember Colby Granville says staffers have told him that could happen without much effort and no more money spent by the city.
You know, it has all the elements of everything a city government likes. It's a measurable, attainable, progressive goal that's in alignment with the city's values that doesn't cost anyone any money. Done. And so what it means is our single-family residences will go from 34% to 40% trash diversion, and that'll be recycling, but that'll also be grass clippings and tree trimmings and all these
green waste.
Yeah, exactly. Green waste that'll become mulch instead of going into a landfill like it does now. That means multifamily apartment complexes going from 3% diversion, which is an atrocious number, to 9%. Of course, we'd like that number to be better, but improvement's improvement. And for industrial and commercial to go to 25%, up from about 7 or 10% now, that would put us at a citywide average of about 25% of our trash that could go to a landfill that simply will not go there anymore.
How much of these goals is dependent on Tempe residents changing their behavior?
It is. You know, all of this is contingent upon Tempe residents changing their behavior, but not in a way that's mandated. This was not a mandate, you must do X, Y, and Z. These are the kind of things that it's going to be a combination of education with some policy changes. So I can give you an example. We do lots of events at Tempe Beach Park. Those events often have some sort of recycling. However, not all of them do, and they're not required to according to our city code. That's likely to change. What's likely to happen in the next 6 months is staff is going to come back to us and say, hey, remember those goals you said you wanted us to reach? Now let us show you the 10 things we got to do to reach those goals. And one of those is likely to be that if you want to do an event at Tempe Beach Park, you're going to have a plan. You're going to have a recycling person that we interact with. You're going to have to keep your recycling clean so that we're not picking up your recycling and essentially looking at it and being like, oh, this is all not recycling, and taking it to the dump. And so there will be some changes that'll have to happen, but the hope is that through a process of persuasion and policy, it'll be pretty painless for most people.
What other kinds of policy changes do you envision potentially happening?
You know, I think a lot of it's going to be, you'll notice when I went through those listings of the changes in diversion rates, the biggest jump is actually for commercial and industrial. And there's a reason for that. That's really the low-hanging fruit for us in Tempe right now, because it's a question of going to a business and saying, look, right now you do X, Y, and Z. We come out, we pick up your trash twice a week. Every time we pick up your trash, we charge you. If you do these things that we know will help offset some of that, we'll give you the recycling bin for free. We'll pick up the recycling bin for free. And if we start coming out to empty your trash from twice a week to once a week, we're actually going to bill you less. And so in some cases, you know, business owners mean well, but they've got a million things going on and they're in the business of making money, as they should be. And so if the city staff can go out and say, look, we can save you money by doing this other thing and help us achieve their goals, you know, I think that's going to be a win for everybody. It's really going to be just a question of going out and feet on the ground talking to people.
It sounds like you're going with the carrot approach more than the stick approach here.
Yeah, we are going with a carrot approach more than a stick approach. That's absolutely true.
So these goals are for 2020. What happens at that point? You may or may not be on the council at that point, but what would you like to see happen at that point as far as how Tempe looks at, okay, this is where we are, this is where we'd like to go at that point?
You know, one of the things that's come up in the last 3 years I've been on council, what existed in the 1950s or the 1970s or the 1990s is simply not the world we live in today. 20%, 25% trash renewal by 2020 is, in my mind, it's a good goal, it's an aggressive goal, but it's the new normal. And I would anticipate that by 2020, frankly, we would have another new normal.
Tempe City Councilman Colby Granville, we were talking about the city's new goals to almost double the recycling diversion in Tempe. Councilman Granville, thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's the show with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. This weekend in Mesa, six downtown businesses were transformed into tattoo shops. A barber shop and a boutique, a coffee shop, and even an audio equipment store. The businesses hosted tattoo artists from around the valley in a pop-up tattooing event that came and went in a day. At Nebula Vaping on Main Street, Dominic Romero is finishing up a tattoo on a customer, three small purple hearts on the top of her foot. Nearby, Juan Hernandez waits patiently for his turn under the needle.
This is his whole arm right here. I'm his canvas. I've known him since he was a kid, so I let him draw on my arm, you know.
Hernandez shows the tattoo sleeve of intricate skulls on his arm, all inked by Romero. Of course, that was in an actual tattoo shop. Hernandez says this feels a little different.
Kind of, because there's like lots of strangers here.
Spectators were also packed into Prime Cut and Sew a block away. It's a boutique and barber shop that opened this summer. Roman Romero is one of the store owners and says when he was growing up here, downtown Mesa was not weird. Now things are changing.
We just really want to try to change that stigma and get people down to downtown Mesa and let them know that it has so much more to offer and it's growing really fast right now.
So that got us thinking, can a day-long tattooing bonanza help make downtown Mesa a destination?
To get an answer to that question, I spoke with one of the event's creators and also the chair of the Mesa Arts and Crafts Festival, Mark Svoboda. Mark, what did you hope a pop-up tattoo event would accomplish?
The initial expectations were to draw some traffic to downtown Mesa, kind of get an eye turned towards the tattoo industry. The downtown historic district has not had tattoos in quite a while. Has had any tattooing. It's all been outside of the square mile. And Mesa is becoming more progressive and trying to bring more art into the city. Mayor John Giles has a little drive called hashtag Make Mesa Weirder. So we're trying to get some new things in there. I think it was the right time. We timed it with the Dia de los Muertos festival at the Mesa Arts Center.
Yeah.
So what better time to do tattoos than Day of the Dead?
Did you see a cross-section of folks?
Actually, there was everything from I saw little kids standing in the windows watching people get tattooed. There was a pretty broad range. People in their 70s and 80s out walking. Had their dogs out walking because we went till 9 p.m. and everybody, you know, a lot of people in Mesa walk their dogs in the evening. And they walk on Main Street because downtown Mesa is pet friendly. And they would stop and watch in the window and stuff like that. And I know we had some walk-ins from that. I know we had one artist that during the eight-hour period did 9 tattoos. All small, but he did manage to get 9 tattoos done during that period of time.
In your opinion, we're putting this in the positive sense of what weird is. Do you think Mesa needs to get weirder?
I don't know if it necessarily needs to get weirder, but Mesa needs to become more of a destination. It's downtown Mesa. Everybody knows what Mill Avenue is. I would love to see downtown Mesa become like that. It has been so conservative down there for so long, and it's now shifting more towards the progressive side and the liberal side, and we're getting more art. Downtown Mesa now has a microbrewery. We have galleries now. We have some of the best coffee shops in the East Valley are on Main Street in downtown Mesa. You know, so, and we have a lot of eclectic little shops that do things. We have a toy bodega. We have comic book shops, stuff like that. So it's changing. It's changing for the better. There's a whole beautification project going on with street murals and stuff like that, painting and art on the colonnades and stuff. So it's getting there. It is getting there, and I'd like to see more.
Tattoos are much more common than they used to be, and it seems like they're more accepted. Are you seeing that?
You talk to any tattoo artist or anybody with tattoos, there is a story, always. It wasn't just, oh, let's just go get a tattoo. There's a meaning, always, because they are for life. And years ago, I mean, it was such a stigma to have a tattoo. Now it's almost become a stigma to not have a tattoo. I mean, so many people have them, and so many different walks of life are getting them.
Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. In Valley traffic, I-70 northbound, a crash at Union Hills has the center lanes blocked. Also watch out on I-70 northbound and central for an object on the roadway. Sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon. Look for a high in the upper 80s. Clear tonight, overnight lows in the mid-60s. It's 87 degrees at KJZZ at 2:52.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Center for Cancer Care, with 55 specialists on staff, 40 offices valley-wide, and a personalized treatment plan. Cancer doesn't stand a chance. More at arizonaccc.com.
Tonight is a full moon, and it just might make us crazy. At least that's what people have believed for millennia. From ancient Egypt to modern-day America, full moons have been blamed for a grab bag of things, from bumper crops of babies to violent mood swings. Even the word lunacy derives from the Latin word for moon. But science has yet to prove whether the so-called lunar effect is real. So KJZZ's Stina Sieg went out to try to document its effects.
A full moon is just starting to rise as I sit at my first stop of the night, Fire Station 271 in Tempe. But the guys don't seem to be gearing up for a string of wild calls. They're throwing dice to see who's going to clean the kitchen.
Oh!
Son of a...
Yes!
11.
Brandon George says some of his fellow firefighters believe in lunar effect. Some don't. But they're all aware of this idea of moon madness.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's always the, you know, the talk. But I don't know if it's really true or not. I don't know. We'll see.
And then the next call rolls in. We race to downtown Tempe, where a man says he was attacked by a posse of strangers. I ask firefighter John Garza if this all sounds pretty typical.
Just for somebody to jump out of a car, five individuals to beat somebody up, not too normal, I don't think.
Garza then answers my next question before I even ask it.
Maybe it's the full moon.
The next call is even stranger. A woman has been thrown from a moving car onto a sidewalk. She's combative, and firefighters say she's been drinking. After she's loaded up into an ambulance, I leave for Phoenix Fire Station 18, the busiest in the valley. I hear they've already had a large number of calls, all of them assaults. That's unusual, unless you're a believer in the power of a full moon.
It's a big trigger.
Dave Campbell is the owner of the astrology store in Glendale. An astrologer and medium himself, he says things tend to come to fruition in the full moon, and that people's feelings are right there on the surface.
They're more emotional in general, whether it's happy, sad, elated, whatever.
Dozens of studies on crime rates and hospital admissions and car crashes have tried to prove this, but none definitively have, and many contradict one another. In fact, I could not find one scientist comfortable enough with the theory of lunar effect to even talk about it. But Campbell says that doesn't mean it's not real. And he says it's not necessarily a bad thing.
I mean, it's just energy, and it's working, knowing how to work with the energy in a positive way instead of a negative.
A positive way, like giving birth. Pam DeGraff is a massage therapist and doula at Baby Moon Inn Birth Center in Central Phoenix. She says a few times this year, half a dozen women with due dates days or weeks apart started laboring at nearly the same time.
Oh, I definitely thought it was moon related.
It just makes sense, she says, that the moon would affect a woman's body.
We have 28-day cycles, just like the moon does, but obviously no proof and no expectations.
No expectations, unless you're someone like me, trying to find answers for this moon mythology. Back to my full night of fire station hopping, I arrive at Phoenix Fire Station 18 to this.
Well, you missed it.
Captain Brad Archer says the night was busy, but died off just as it got there. When I talk about lunar effect, he smiles. Sometimes he says, it is crazy in a full moon.
Believe me, we've had plenty of crazy nights here at 18 that is not attributed with any type of full moon as well.
He then lets me into a little bit of firefighter folklore, the idea that calls fall away when someone like me comes to observe. It's called the ride-along curse. But that's another story. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
No, your radio is not possessed. Don't worry, it's just a trick. This time of year, you'll see and hear a lot of tricks at haunted houses to spook visitors. But the show's Annika Klein takes us to one haunted place that sets the mood not with tricks, but with history.
The Orpheum Theater in downtown Phoenix doesn't have to try too hard to look haunted. Opened in 1929, the theater is the last remaining movie palace in Phoenix. The Spanish Baroque architecture, red velvet seats, and a powerful pipe organ resurrect a bygone age.
It was an actual romantic and somewhat scandalous and somewhat colorful history that I never realized until I started looking into it.
Joe Atreides runs Phoenix Ghost Tours. He's volunteered to give tours of the Orpheum during Halloween week this year. First stop, the second floor, right above the theater's marquee sign.
This is the manager's office.
Atreides says this is where the theater's first manager, Harry Nace, used to work. And some think he's still here.
They've seen him through the windows. They've seen him from the building across the street. Some people have even reported someone walking along the second floor right over here, where you see there's no floor to walk on.
Atreides points to where the second floor balcony opens up to look down on the first floor. He says sightings and photos of ghosts pique his interest, and then he sets out to disprove them.
About 90% of the stuff I could discount, or maybe just say is a good chance it could be something else. But was that 10% that was left over that the least craziest explanation was that it was a ghost?
It's that 10% that Atreides simply can't explain. That becomes the material for his ghost tours. Then he digs into historical records to try to connect the supernatural reports to a real person. His Orpheum tour actually includes five ghosts, four humans, and a cat. Luis Ruiz has been the venue manager of the Orpheum for 8 years and says talk of ghosts around here is common.
It happens all the time. I hear it from staff. I hear it from visitors. I hear it from my friends. I hear it from coworkers.
Granted, theaters are naturally superstitious places. The Orpheum, for example, has a collection of rubber duckies backstage that no one is allowed to move or else the show will go wrong. But Atreides says it's less about seeing ghosts and more about reviving their stories in a building that is one of Phoenix's most historic places.
I want to give someone the access to a place they hadn't experienced before.
Proceeds go back to the Orpheum, and the tours start tomorrow night. It's the show. I'm Annika Klein.
Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. I would like to personally invite you to stay tuned tomorrow morning at 11 for KJZZ's Here and Now, hosted by Steve Goldstein. And Steve, you know, you have an hour, so who are you going to call tomorrow?
Well, we're not going to have Ray Parker on to talk about Ghostbusters. But, Mark, we'll start the program off with the director of the Department of Economic Security, Mr. Tim Jeffries.
Been in the news a lot lately.
Making some news a lot. And actually, he's been in office for about 8 months at this point. We hadn't heard much about him until recently, but we're going to talk primarily about how the agency has changed in the wake of CPS moving on to its own agency.
Also, you'll be talking to the director of a movie, sort of not a Hollywood blockbuster, but something that is near and dear to a lot of Arizonans' hearts.
Yeah, Mark, as we know, we need water here in the desert, as everyone else does. Well, this is about the Groundwater Management Act of 1980, which doesn't sound sexy in and of itself, but it's a very well-made documentary, really interesting, important topic. We'll be talking with the director about that.
That's KJZZ's Here and Now, tomorrow morning at 11, hosted by Steve Goldstein. The show was produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Annika Klein, Regina Revazova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are the digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer. News director Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban. Thank you so much for listening. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. All Things Considered is next. It's 3 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Xavier College Prep, a Roman Catholic high school for young women, hosting an open house Sunday, November 1st from noon to 3 p.m. with student-led campus tours and access to faculty and coaches. Info at xcp.org.